and welcome to GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students here at Western University. I am one of your hosts, Mark Ambrosio.
And I'm pulling up the rear as your other host, Liam Clifford.
Liam, I know you did your undergraduate at the University of Toronto, and Toronto has a very famous, very modernist library. I believe it's called the Robarts Library, is it not?
It is indeed, yeah. It's actually in the shape of a peacock with its plumage branched out. So it's quite a sight, and it's brutalist architecture at its finest. So there's only so much lipstick you can put on a pig, but it is a remarkable building. It's also because of the weight of the books, it's actually sinking into its foundation every year. So what a wonderful introduction for our guest today, Mark.
I know. Yes, I forgot about that sinking part. But yes, as modernist as the D.B. Weldon Library is, there's one even more so. And so speaking of libraries, I'm delighted to welcome today someone I met here in the library science program at Western, Alisa Prendergast. Alisa, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and the Master of Library and Information Science program?
Hi, everyone. My name is Alisa, and as Mark said, I'm in the Master of Library and Information Science program here at Western. I've been here for a few semesters. We're close to the end. It's a program. I'd say mainly the demographic at Western's program is people who are looking to become librarians and work in the library world. But we are also information science as well. So we have a lot of people going into like IT fields, analyst roles. But I would say for me, I am specifically looking to be in libraries, hopefully, for a really long time.
That's amazing. I was reviewing some of the stuff you had sent, and my experience in my master's is not a professional program. So would you illuminate us onto what that looks like for you?
Absolutely. So when a lot of people think of grad school, they think of doing thesis-based research. Our program is a professional program, so while there is the option to do guided research, independent study, the majority of us are just doing course-based. But you do get to do a lot of fun research within those courses, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's. I mean, we got a couple of projects to talk about today. So why don't we just start off with the one that really did seem like it provoked the most interest in you, the history of books and basic book preservation. Pardon me if I got that title wrong. You're focusing on Hans Christian Andersen. This is remarkable. Is there a reason why the program or the course or however you want to frame it decided to focus on this work of literature specifically?
For sure. So for this course, History of the Book and Basic Book Preservation, this was just a really exciting course. We get to do a lot of hands-on work with Ariel Vandershans, who's also a PhD student in FIMS and actually works for Western Libraries as well. Ariel's course has a lot of hands-on components about looking at how books are made and what they're made of and how that's changed over time. So for this project, my colleagues Amelia Ritchie and Cree Davis and I, we got to choose a book from the Rare Books and Special Collections here at Western Library. So
we got to
actually go into the Special Collections and browse the shelves and see all of these really, really old books.
Oh, that's really neat.
It was, absolutely. We were so excited to see some beautiful artwork inside of this work specifically. Fairy Tales by Hans Andersen with illustrations by Kay Nielsen. We also really loved that this book was quite big. It's not just a novel that you would pick up off the shelf. It is poor measurement, but I'd say as tall as from the end of my fingertip to my elbow. It's a pretty big book.
Right, so we're dealing with a tome here, not a book.
Yes. Absolutely.
Very good.
Alisa, may I ask, so as you alluded to earlier, the Master Library and Information Science program, it brings together library science, like the professional study of librarianship, and information science. So like not everyone necessarily wants to be a librarian. Some people are studying things like information technology. This sounds like it's very much grounded in librarianship. And like, what was it like having, because you mentioned that you had Ariel Vandershan as a professor, she's a PhD student and she works at Western Library. Did it change the atmosphere of the course from some earlier courses, like having that practical emphasis?
I would say yes. I'm used to always being throughout undergrad, at least, in more like theory-based courses, less so actually getting to get my hands on things and do more of the practical work. Ariel was just very focused on making it a really exciting experience and also giving us hands-on experience to make sure that we can actually say, hey, we've practiced some of these techniques when it comes to preservation, or even just creating like protective covers for books. Definitely, I would have been excited to learn about the history of books and how they're made, but getting to really do workshops in class and practice these skills just made it, it was definitely everyone's most exciting course of the week, even at 9 a.m. on whatever day of the week it was.
We can bring it back to the first project that we were discussing about the Andersen fairy tales, because I mean these fairy tales are prevalent throughout the world, right? The Little Mermaid, of course, is a Disney movie that's been recently remade. So can you confirm for us, this was an exclusive copy of this of only, you know, certain amount in existence, is that correct?
That's true. There were only 500 copies made of this special edition book of fairy tales.
Okay, that is remarkable. I have here it's number 254, based on our conversation earlier. So that is quite remarkable. So we are dealing with a book that, is it fair to say it's over 100 years old? Is it approaching that?
This was actually 100 years this year. It is from 1924 that it was published.
Wow. Okay, so I need to talk then about the preservation methods, because I was struck by the description of the books in terms of physical components. We often, especially in academia, we look at books purely for content matter. We don't look at anything to have to do with the physical components of what keeps a book together. So my question for you is, depending on what the book is bound with, what sort of materials it uses, do the preservation methods change based on that material?
Yes, so definitely the different materials that are used will affect how you fix a book, depending on the material, let's say, of the material covering the spine and the covers. If you are mending that material, the type of adhesive you'd use would really depend on what, let's say, fabric is being used, and whether that would bind properly, whether it would cause damage over time. When we are making these fixes, well, not me specifically, but when people in the field are making these mending jobs, they are above all looking to make sure that this book lasts longer. They never want to cause any more damage by fixing something. So they really need to be aware of what materials they are working with and make sure that they actually have the right supplies to be able to work with it properly.
Of course. And, you know, I'm doing my PhD with the history department here, and we often work with archivists and librarians to avail of the sources that we require in order to write our dissertations. So I find the distinct preservation methods really important, particularly in this day and age of digitization. You know, you really can't manufacture a 100-year-old book of which there's only 500 copies left. It would seem like a travesty to see that fall to the wayside. So it's remarkable in that regard. Tell me this much, apart from the physical descriptions of the book, have you been able to read any of the book? Have you been able to enjoy some of the fairy tales? Are you already familiar with the source itself?
So unfortunately, we didn't get to spend time reading the stories ourselves. I'm not sure if one of my colleagues might have taken a few extra moments to do so. For the most part, honestly, the stories in there were titles, at least, that I was unfamiliar with.
Okay.
Hans Andersen's work is well known across the world. But it was, it was cool to see that there were so many stories that maybe I didn't know, or perhaps glancing at the page, I think I don't know it, but if I had have spent a few more minutes there, they might be stories that I'm very familiar with from childhood, and just maybe from used to different characters' names, especially depending on what cultural perspective of that fairy tale he was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of different versions.
Yeah, I like what Leah mentioned earlier about how in academia we often think of a book, we usually think of a book in terms of its contents, but this project that you're talking about and the whole class in general, history of the book, sounds like it's dealing with books not just in terms of content, but more so in terms of the physical artifact. So speaking of the physical artifact, do you mind unpacking for us what was involved in the project, the group project that you did for the class?
Yes, so there were two parts to this project, both related to fairy tales by Hans Andersen and Kay Nielsen. So the first part was that we actually did a descriptive bibliography of this book, which is really documenting all the physical characteristics, whether that there are pictures in it, or it's made of this material, or there's this sort of damage here, might be caused by something. And then we also used the ArcGIS story map software to do a presentation to our class about the physical description of the book, as well as some history on the author and the illustrator and the book itself.
And Elisa, illuminate for the uninitiated, what is ArcGIS?
So ArcGIS, this was my first time using it when we did this project. But ArcGIS is a, well, first, GIS is, I believe I'm getting this right, Global Information, Geographic Information software. I hope I'm not getting that wrong.
You got that right.
Thank you. So it is a type of software that you would use to share information. Usually it's using maps. It's not the only way to do it, but a way to present data is, let's say, showing clusters on a map, just to give people another way of understanding information. They can. It's a good way to present stats visually, and also draw connections where you may not be able to see them without physically looking at them on a page or a screen. So when it came to our project, we didn't quite use it. We didn't put any maps in ours, unfortunately, but it is a presentation software. So it's a great way to make an online, rather than using like a PowerPoint where you have individual slides, this is something where you can scroll all the way through and just sort of seamlessly travel through bits of information. You can also, with the map functions in this type of software, you can attach text points onto a photo or onto a map so people can click around on an image of their town, let's say, and find a bit of information about this really famous street. Again, for us, we used it more for images and a bit for videos, but it was, yeah, a nice way to present our project and kind of give it more of a professional finish.
Elisa, so I think from our pre-interview conversation, you mentioned that one of the other classes you've been involved in is accessibility and information environments, and that you had another group project for that class as well. So what was that class about? And then maybe we can narrow in on the project.
Yeah, so that was the accessibility and information environments course that I took with Dr. Heather Hill last summer. Very popular course that only runs once a year. I was very excited to get in. And we talk, of course, about accessibility in different environments and what that can look like, whether it's you talking about the workplace. Usually accessibility, we think of customers and patrons, but employees are often an overlooked group when it comes to considering access, supportive devices. That was one of my favorite parts, and I think a lot of my classmates too, was getting to talk about how it might be for people who are in the field and what they can expect from their employer or what they should expect. We even talked about things like the type of furniture that you purchase when you're refitting your library, how far apart things need to be, how far apart should each of the aisles be or the chairs.
It sounds like a very, very good class. I've had Heather Hill, Professor Heather Hill is actually on my committee, and she's a great, great professor and important member of the FIMS community. But these questions of accessibility are really important, as you know, Elisa, because sometimes public libraries are, not so much in London, I don't think, but sometimes public libraries are in older buildings, sometimes buildings, you know, have been grandfathered and may not be always adhering to modern accessibility legislation or codes. I wonder if you could maybe speak to that.
Yes. Funny enough, a lot of libraries actually are in buildings that were not built to be libraries. And sometimes the structure really can't support them physically. That's less of an accessibility issue. But yeah, sometimes you'll find a library in the second floor of a house that is just not prepared to hold all those books on it. When it comes to public libraries, yes, a lot of them are in very old buildings or buildings that just have not, unfortunately, are not up to standard with the public's accessibility needs. These are things that we may think of in general with buildings, like lack of ramps, lack of washrooms accessible to everyone who's coming in, whether that's universal washrooms or just washrooms that have sinks that are at a an appropriate level for everyone. Well, I haven't been the one to make those sorts of decisions about making accessibility changes in libraries myself. Unfortunately, it is a really long process to make such changes, but very important ones that have to happen. So hopefully we continue to see better physical accessibility in public libraries over time. Luckily, one area that can be improved a little more quickly is signage. Often, at least here in Ontario, most of it is in English. So knowing your population and your community and what the most common languages are, things like just making sure that you have signage in multiple languages, making sure it's large enough for people to read without having to be directly in front of it. That's just one example of a change that is a bit easier and quicker to make, luckily.
That's a very good example. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, no, I'm struck by finding the ideal building, because it's amazing how architecture can inhibit or provide the means for inclusion for these spaces. And as a library, being so patron forward in terms of ensuring that it can provide the services, I think that's unequivocally important. So I appreciate you sharing that. I want to circle back to the accessibility information environments for a moment. You mentioned a test. I beg your pardon. It's spelled FRIES. I don't want to say fries or freeze. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. But I think this is really important to speak about. So could you elaborate a little more on what that constitutes?
So the FRIES test, developed by Kenny Fries, is a measure that can be used to judge whether disability representation is good disability representation. You may have a disabled character in your book, but is it actually good representation? That was what Kenny Fries was looking for. So the qualities of this test: is there more than one disabled character in your story? Do they have their own narrative purpose within the story that is not meant to benefit non-disabled characters? And do they stay disabled by the end of the book, as opposed to being cured? Or becoming healthy again. With the Fries test, when we used this for our project, we were actually creating a collections resource about for collections librarians, if they wanted to purchase books for teens that have disability representations. We gave recommendations of books that could be included that have lots of different types of disabilities represented. And this was a way for us to look and see, to make sure that we were actually providing good suggestions that we hope patrons will really enjoy reading.
Yeah, absolutely. And picking up on that point, I found it remarkable. It doesn't act as like an unequivocal adjudication, of course. No theory does. But the fact that it was able to represent a guide for you guys to ensure that we promote more inclusive literature that, as you said, is constructive and provides dignified representations of what these things look like, I think is really, really important. So that's wonderful. And in developing these lists, this is gonna get personal, not in a bad way though. Do you ever go through these lists and you look at the books and you're like, I really want to read that in my spare time?
I know that happened when we were making the list. Unfortunately, I can't remember any specific titles. But it was a great way to get familiar with titles that I wasn't used to seeing.
Of course.
And I think that really speaks to why this was such a good idea for us to do as a project, even if it was mainly to use in class. Most of these books I had never heard about before. And I think that speaks to the fact that we maybe don't have, we probably never have as much disability representation in books as we could. At least not maybe in the mainstream. So it was great to be exposed to a lot more titles.
Yeah, and I certainly wasn't calling you up on bringing up any particular titles. But I find that even when I casually go through books lists of any nature, of any genre, I find that there are always ones that the title piques my interest, or I recognize the author, and that sort of drums up. So I'm wondering too, does your passion for this professional career that you're pursuing ever delve into the personal, where you're reading these books in your spare time and that you're truly immersing yourself? Or is it a case of, do I just shut off and leave it for school?
I would say that this semester right now is actually a great example of it's coming home with me, without a better way to say it. I'm currently in a course on comics and librarianship.
Cool.
So I have read so many comics since January, and that wasn't a type of book that I was used to reading. Mm-hmm. So right now I haven't been a nonfiction reader, but reading nonfiction in comic book format has actually been very interesting to me, mm-hmm. Particularly graphic medicine, which is discourse on the medical field and healthcare, but in a comic book format, usually told as a narrative. You get to see people's experiences with, let's say, going through a surgery or with a certain disability. Again, as a nonfiction reader, I've been reading those books outside of class now.
Of course. Of course.
I think that's one of the interesting things about library science, is that, in my experience, people who are taking the program, yes, it's a professional program, but it often tends to be a passion, an overlapping between one's professional interests and one's personal interests. And that everyone, I shouldn't say everyone, but most people in my experience who are taking library science tend to be avid readers. They tend to enjoy the library environment and tend to enjoy the idea of working in the public sector. It can be a very, as you know, Elisa, a very course heavy program, much more so than the PhDs that Liam and I are in, and people sometimes don't appreciate how heavy the MLIS is. One of the more interesting courses that you told us about prior to our interview was special libraries, and it sounds like you did a very interesting project for that course. So do you mind telling us, A, what special libraries are, like what was the course about, and then B, what did you do for that project?
Yes, so special libraries themselves are non-academic and non-public libraries, I'd say is an easy way to explain it. So that could be a library for a corporation or the Library of Parliament or a library in a hospital. Those are all libraries that have a specific demographic that they are helping out.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do? So it sounds like you had a very interesting project for that course. What was the project?
Yes, I loved this one. I worked on this one with Daria Hodge and Joe Q. We created our own special library, actually located here on campus. We created the Comics Resource Center, located in the basement of the basement of the University Community Center is where we chose.
So it actually exists?
It does not exist, unfortunately, only in our minds. But Western actually has, I believe, one of the biggest mm-hmm. comic book collections in the world, if mm-hmm. I'm remembering right. I believe there's around at least 70,000 items in this collection at Western, many of them uncatalogued. It's a lot of work that will hopefully be done over time. We'll see. But we were hoping to create a library to help students, professors, and traveling scholars as well engage with these titles and build a community of practice around comic scholarship.
That sounds like a really neat project and a worthwhile one for a variety of reasons, not least of which yesterday I was wandering the basement of the UCC and thinking to myself, what an underutilized space this is. And I mean, I love the ambiance of the 1970 classrooms down there, which are very seldom used, but I think that would be a very worthwhile way to use those spaces. Before we wrap up, Elisa, maybe you can tell us what brought you to library science? Like, did you do undergraduate here at Western? And if so, what did you do your undergraduate in? And what brought you to library science?
Yes, so I was here at Western for my undergrad. I was at King's University College, and I studied, I did a double major in psychology and English language and literature. This might come as no surprise, me being in library science now, but the English I tacked on for fun. I took a course in first year initially and then just said, oh, might as well make a program out of this too, because I had such a great time. When it comes to the library program itself, It was something that was suggested to me growing up, becoming a librarian. I love to read, which I will say to those listening, you don't have to be an avid reader to be a librarian. Mm-hmm. Many of us are. You absolutely do not need to be. But coming to this program, I'd say two things. One, my best friend, actually, that I've gone to school with for a long time, entered this program a year before me, and I would just ask her questions and questions and questions, and everything sounded so exciting and exactly what I wanted to do. The other part, actually, was from a friend that I really looked up to in undergrad. She was in Teachers College a few years ago, and she knows me really well. She's someone that I really aspire to be like, and she had been taking a school library course at her Teachers College here at Western, and she just texted me one day and said, you know what, I think you would be such a fantastic children's librarian. I think you would love this, and I think you would do a really good job. And that, I'd say, was the big push. And really, I am hoping to be a children or teen librarian now. So it was so exciting to hear that from someone that I looked up to.
Well, Elisa, not only do I think you'd be a good librarian, I know you'll be a good children's or teens services librarian. So, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And what a wonderful note to end on in you fleshing out your passion to us. That's really a remarkable thing. So thank you for joining us today. And this has been GradCast, the official radio show and podcast of the Society of Graduate Students at Western University. I've been your host, Liam Clifford, and my co-host was Mark Ambrosio. We've been speaking with Elisa Prendergast, and this episode was produced by Amelie Hutchinson. If you'd like to be involved with the show or get in contact with us, email us at gradcast@sogs.ca. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at GradCast Radio. To listen to us, we are on Radio Western 94.9 FM. You can also find all of our episodes wherever you can find your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and have yourself a wonderful rest of the day. Cheers.